Hey, Zero Block 30 listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Prime members can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Summer is all about the freedom to have fun. Forget a vacation and take a tequila-cation with new Truly Tequila Soda. This refreshing blend of real fruit juice from concentrate, sparkling water, and premium tequila blanco is the drink of the summer. Try all four refreshing flavors, all with 5% ABV and just 100 calories. Truly Tequila Soda. Keep it light. Hard Seltzer Beverage Company, Boston, Massachusetts. Please drink responsibly.
This week's Zero Block 30 is brought to you by Movement Watches. MVMT Watches Movement was founded on the belief that style shouldn't break the bank. The watchmaker's goal is to change the way consumers think about fashion by offering high-quality, minimalist products at a revolutionary price. With over 500,000 watches sold to customers in over 160 countries around the world, MVMT Watches has solidified itself as the world's fastest-growing watch company. I don't know if you guys know this, I'm a watch guy. I got a bunch of watches. The thing about watches, though, they're expensive. So, you thinking about what outfit you want to wear? Go out on the town, New York City. Got to put a good watch to your outfit because guess what? There's nothing better than getting a nice compliment from a female or a male that says, hey, nice watch. Now, with Movement Watches, they don't break the bank. Starting at just $95, you can get yourself a real nice watch to pair with that outfit. So, get 15% off today with free shipping, free returns by going to mvmtwatches.com/chaps, all caps. This watch has a really clean design. No, seriously, I'm wearing one today right now. Ever since I got it, everyone, compliment city.
Looks sexy.
Thank you. So now you got to step. Everyone else, you got to step up your watch game. Go to mvmtwatches.com/chaps. Do it today.
This week's episode of Zero Block 30 is brought to you by Lisa Mattresses. Lisa Mattresses are innovative, and they're a new online mattress company. They're just like Tom's Shoes or Warby Parker of the mattress industry. They're available exclusively online, and they start at the low, low price of $525. And if you live in New York City, you can't do shit for $525, but you can sleep on one of the best mattresses in the world. The mattress sits compressed in a box directly to your door. It's a 100-night risk-free trial. That means you can do sex on it. You can do whatever you want to 100 nights. Probably not golden showers. That might be something that you can't do.
Topical joke, nice.
Yeah, yeah, thanks. You get a 100-night free trial, which is pretty unbelievable. Free shipping anywhere in the world, 100% American-made, unlike our president's ties, and a 10-inch hybrid foam.
Two for two.
Ooh. A 10-inch hybrid foam mattress with 3-inch premium foam layers, all kinds of real technical shit about mattresses, man. Like, they're really good mattresses. With Lisa's 110 program, we donate 110 to a shelter for every 10 we sell. We also plant a tree. Like, they're doing all kinds of stuff. They're planning to pledge 1 million trees. Go to lisa.com/barstool for $75. That's LEESA.com. Or for you military types, Lima Echo, Echo Sierra Alpha dot Charlie Oscar Mike /barstool for 75% off. Let's go.
Capitalism, baby.
Yeah, capitalism. That's all about.
America.
We're trying to make a little bit of money here.
Great reads, by the way, boys. How about Japs? Two topical jokes in there?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you just got to switch it up, man. I want the listeners to be happy. Don't want them just to smash that 15-second fast-forward button 130 times.
That's, no. Yeah, you can't have that.
We got Japs in office this week.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's nice to actually, because if you're listening and you don't know, I live in Texas, and usually we Skype in through our fancy studio, and we hang out via Skype. So whenever I actually come in and get to hug the boys, it's a good time. So it's nice to be in studio with you boys.
It's good to have you. Hectic week.
Very hectic week. It's been nuts. Recording this on Friday of this week. Just finished up Barstool Idol. Chaps, you must be happy. Another ginger on
the pirate
ship. No, fuck that,
man. Like, I was going to say that. I was going to say, but no. Like, the guys, there's two people that do the things that I do. Like, they're like a guy that cooks. I'm the cooker, man. Like, I write the fucking Christmas blog about cooking. That's me. I'm the ginger guy. I'm the one that talks about sun shirts. That's my thing.
That's your shtick. That's your
it's part of who I am.
Yeah.
I completely agree, and I mean I just shot out a tweet. I don't want to like be like, oh, all I do is talk about Harvard, but we got another Harvard guy now too. So I basically shot off a
tweet.
You
went to Harvard?
That like yeah. Oh yeah.
Wow.
I shot off a tweet that like if we get a cross-eyed dude in here now, I'm fucked. Like I gotta
I'm done. You guys are both getting sniped left and right.
Yeah, so France's old friends putting a little bit of a. We got to put some pop in our step, keep our game up.
I got to be honest. Never did I think Barstool would get two Harvard guys. one was a stretch, but to get two is pretty ridiculous.
I'm rattled. I'm not happy about it.
You better get on your game, buddy.
I got to step it up.
No doubt about that. When I was watching Barstow Idol, though, it reminded me of some of the things that were happening this week when the guys were getting grilled about their videos, why their videos were good. We had a couple other people that were getting grilled this week, and that was going through some of the confirmation. Did any of the guys getting trying to get confirmed, any of them stick out to you guys?
I feel like Mattis, one of the funniest parts was Mattis stuck out because he had some smoke show behind him.
Yeah.
And then I had some stoolie.
Smoke show used loosely.
Yeah, no, definitely. Like, relative to that environment.
Right.
She was a smoke show. Everybody was going nuts on the internet about it. I had a stoolie who...
I mean, she was a Senate hearing smoke show.
Yeah, Senate hearing 10, for sure.
Yeah.
And some stoolie emailed me being like, I know this chick. She's actually his comms director. Like, she's kind of rattled because she feels like it's, like, unprofessional. And I was like, it's never not a compliment to be called a smoke show on the internet.
Yeah. And, I mean, what are you supposed to do? Not look how
I
you
feel
look?
Like that's not... If she's in the position to be... General Mass's communication director, she probably doesn't want to be known for being in that meeting because she's attractive.
See, that might be a little civilian military, you know, difference there. That doesn't relate to me.
Yeah, no, I think...
I mean, it makes sense.
No, yeah, Chaps is right. Like, you know, it's a very serious position, and you're making decisions that are going to impact lives of many men and women in uniform, so you don't want to be distracting.
Because you're the communication director, right? I think she was Mass's...
Yeah, she's like a either comms director or something in comms, for sure.
So did you guys hear that Mattis actually doesn't like the nickname Mad Dog?
I didn't hear that, but why?
Well, he doesn't like it because he says that it's not a thinking man's nickname. And he, when he was in Iraq and throughout his career, his Marines gave it to him because of his battlefield behavior. That whenever he was going to locate, close with, and destroy the enemy by fire and close combat, he did it.
Yeah, and absolutely.
Like, there was like no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that you want that nickname. Like, you can be a general, go in and destroy shit, but still be a very cerebral guy. And I feel people that got their first real exposure for what General Mattis was like, they saw that he was an extremely cerebral guy.
Absolutely. And I think it's one of those things, too, where it's a completely different position. So he can kind of separate himself from that Mad Dog persona by the way he acts in this position. It's almost like when you're going to high school and then you go to college, nobody at college knows you. You can kind of be a new person. Obviously, we know Mattis, we know his history, but he's going to have opportunities that he was never presented with in the military and the ability to make decisions to where he can further demonstrate him being cerebral. So I think it's a great opportunity for him.
Maybe Zero Block 30, we should start calling him Brain Dog. Think you would like that?
The big brain.
Yeah. Big brain.
Yeah. I think that one's already...
Secretary Brain Dog.
Yeah, I think that was already copyrighted in this building, though.
I feel like, too, with Mattis, every time he comes back up, it's just more and more confirmed that he's universally loved.
Yeah.
He really is.
Even all the reaction I'm seeing is like, yeah, you know, loved by both sides, did great, blah, blah, blah. He doesn't get grilled necessarily like the other guys.
No, I was really surprised. I think this is the first time, maybe I just hadn't paid that close of attention before, but a lot of the people that were getting confirmed were kind of straying away from normal Trump things that he talked about on the stump, like where he was when he was out on the campaign trail, what he talked about since he was been in office. Like, they were a lot more strict on Russia. They were more on Iran. They were more about the deal than he was. I mean, there was things that just stuck out throughout the process. Do you guys feel that way, too?
No, absolutely, and I think that bodes well for America and should offer some comfort that, you know, all these people, especially with everything that happened this week with Trump, to know that he has people surrounding him that are firm the other way and they're firm going to keep him in line. And I certainly take it as a positive that we've been getting positive feedback about everything they have said about the various topics.
I agree. I think, too, it kind of highlights why we spent 2, 3, 4 episodes in a row talking about who he was appointing.
Yep.
Because it's really important who's helping the guy out. I mean, it's not a one-man job. Everybody knows that. And of course, he gets all the attention. He either gets all the credit or gets all the blame when shit goes whichever way it goes. But at the end of the day, you need these people to run these gigantic departments. That's why we've gone through how many people, how many billions of dollars each one has, each one's responsible for. And so seeing these guys come out and be like, no, I'm not just falling in line with whatever the Donald says. This is what I believe. This is what I'm here for. Mm-hmm. And it also, you know, you'd like to think that these people said the same things to Trump behind closed doors.
Yep.
And he was like, yeah, I love it.
And you know, those guys that you're referring to now that are getting confirmed, they aren't pussyfooting around the issues. They are going to fucking say what they think. I mean, you don't get to that level being a general by being a coward.
Absolutely, and I also think they'll stand fast on their opinions. They'll stand fast in their positions, and they will combat and go against Trump when they firmly believe that he's in the wrong or, you know, potentially going to make a poor decision. So that's certainly another positive.
Yeah, which Connor said, I feel like everyone looks at that as a very good thing, that these guys are sticking to it and that they're smart, they're experienced, they're confident, and they're not going to back down.
There was two things that Mattis said during the confirmation process that I thought really stuck out to me. One, he said, Senator asked him, what do you feel about the role of women in combat? Because you were on the record before saying why you were an active duty general that you didn't feel like it was appropriate. And his answer to that was, I was an active duty general at the time, so I am responsible to make sure that my Marines, when they hear me answer a question, that I give the question that relies inside the order. So basically he was saying that was the order at the time. My actual feeling on the matter is the standard is the standard. If you meet the standard, that's all that fucking matters.
Working with you, I will endeavor to keep our unique all-volunteer force second to none. We open the door to all patriots who are eligible and meet the standards, provide them with the training, equipment, and leadership essential to their success, and ensure all service members are treated with dignity and respect.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he didn't say fucking, but, I mean, that's basically the...
I wish he did, damn.
Yeah, that's the idea of it, which I agree with. If you meet the standard, do the fucking job.
Absolutely.
If you can't meet the standard, don't do the fucking job.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, I couldn't have agreed with somebody more on that, because people have asked me constantly, like, do you think the role of women in combat, what do you think about that? My answer is General Mass's answer. If you meet the standard, do the fucking job, and if you don't, guy, girl, whoever, get the fuck out of here.
I love, too, that he's aware enough to know, you know, how his answer plays based upon his current role. Mm. I think that's awesome.
Yeah.
And now he's able to, you know, he's going to be the head dog.
Mm-hmm.
And he's saying, you know, no, this is my true beliefs. This is where it's at. But when he was in a different role, he was like, no, this is how it's going to have to play is what I need to say. Again, it
and
speaks
that goes
to
into,
that he's not
and,
just some crazy mad dog.
And like that you could see that as a pretty consistent theme of military leadership. And we'll talk about it more in Zero Black Theater near the end of the show. But that's basically what Tom Hanks did when he said, I don't bitch to juniors.
Yeah.
Like, I bitch to majors and lieutenant colonels. And
gripes go up.
Yeah, gripes go up. And that's basically what he was saying. Like, when I was there, was there policy that you want to be different whenever you're a 3-star general and not a 4-star general?
Absolutely.
Yes, but you're not the commandant. You're not in control of that. Like, so you have to go with what you can do.
Yeah, so along this theme, I read an interesting article at MilitaryTimes.com this week, and they were talking about how in the last 8 years of President Obama's administration, there's been a lot of focus on the social issues within the military. Getting women in combat, transgender folks in the military. And the article was saying how there's a possibility now that those issues might get put on the back burner and more focus put on the fact that we need to strengthen our military. Do you guys both think that is a good thing or a bad thing that we should change our focus for how we're dealing with our military?
Riggsy?
I mean, I think that... Look, it's really hard for somebody like us to say unless you get all the intel, unless you're there, unless you're talking to all the people that you bring in to talk to. So it's one of those that sounds like a little bit of a cop-out answer, but the bottom line is like, how the hell am I supposed to know? Unless you're there, you're getting all the intel you need to get. You can make your decisions based off of that. So change direction is difficult, but at the same time, if you're bringing in a whole new regime, a whole new administration, like, yeah, I guess that should definitely be part of it. I don't think it has to be drastically different, but I don't think you should veer away either from changing a direction.
No, I think there are important issues and topics to discuss, and, you know, as Chaps alluded to, women in combat, if you can do the job, we've talked about this ad nausea, I don't care if you're a woman, but it's just, the article was just saying how there was too much focus on those issues as opposed to focusing on our actual strategy and the strength of our military.
In my opinion, people that make those arguments are the same ones that say that because the ownership of a football team is concentrating on getting stadium built, that means that they're neglecting the team.
Mm-hmm.
Different people are doing different jobs throughout, and I think that the idea that social functions happen through the eyes of the Department of Defense all the time and have throughout American history, whether you're talking about the Marines at Mopper Point, you're talking about Ofa Mae Johnson, the first female Marine, Like, there's always been social change. Segregation happened in the military before it happened in public schools.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the military has always been an element used for social change. One, as an experiment that you could see that it actually works.
Mm-hmm.
Because my experience when I was in and Don't Ask, Don't Tell happened, no one gave a first flying silly little fuck about it.
No.
Like, everybody was just like, this is fine.
Yeah.
Because we know that there's dudes that were fucking other dudes, there was girls that were fucking other girls, and no one gave a shit.
And it didn't affect anybody's ability to do their job.
No.
So it's like, who cares, you know?
Yeah, it didn't affect them at all. And in fact, it made it, when you focus on issues like that, you're taking commanding officers from the 04 level and 06 level
mm-hmm.
and higher and putting their bullshit time dealing with somebody who's gay. For what purpose? I don't know. So I had, there was a general level officer on Quantico, not general level, excuse me, a flag level officer, colonel, who was there. His sole job was investigating Don't Ask, Don't Tell claims on the base, whether it's through OCS or wherever. A fucking colonel is doing that. Like, that is ridiculous. A
waste of time, really. So I think we can agree that they can happen simultaneously. You can focus on your strategy and your mission all the while allowing these social, I don't want to say agendas, but social products to occur and to progress forward in our military.
Yeah, General Mattis said it too in the confirmation hearing. He said that I've never really been too concerned about who a grown man or woman sleeps with.
Yeah.
Right, and I was going to say, I feel like all the social stuff always just gets way more play in the public, in the press, whatever you want to call it, than it actually merits, you know, functionally, its real effect, whatever you want to call it. And so, you know, it almost feels to me like then I would ask the question, because I feel like people want to bring up Don't Ask, Don't Tell because they're like, oh, there must be this tension and this conflict within the military. We should settle it. When in reality, it sounds like,
yeah,
it's like,
chaps
gives
said
a
it.
Shit? Like, what are you talking
nobody
about?
Cared.
They don't give a fuck, man.
Yeah.
Like, and that's the same thing with what's going on with, I know it's a constant theme throughout political discourse that we need to strengthen our military. The military's fucking strong. Like, that, I don't get it. And I don't understand how people who are in the military don't view that as insulting. That we need to strengthen the military again. It is already strong. It's the strongest one in the world, and it's the strongest one the world's ever seen. Is there things that can be improved about it? But to have the notion that our military is somehow weak in the eyes of the world is asinine. Like,
I don't know that it's, I agree with you. We're the strongest military in the world, bar none. I think it's strictly from a number standpoint. I think the weakness argument stems from the fact that we have drawn down our numbers in each of the services. So as a result, people are deploying more often. People feel like we're just stretched a little too thin. I think that's what they mean by weak.
And I would say that just because you don't have 8 copies anymore of a college rough draft because you have to go through back on a typewriter, now you can right click and correct the little red squiggly. I feel like that's what our military has done, that we're no longer writing out penmanship to put it in a typewriter. We're smarter, we're just as efficient, even more efficient, and we're just as lethal.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that if anything, and this almost goes to business or whatever, it's not necessarily that you need to become, you know, stronger, bigger, whatever. So you just need to become as efficient as possible.
Sure. Yeah.
And so if there's efforts, you know, you concert your efforts
if
towards that.
If that was the argument, let's make the military more efficient. Oh, dude, I'll go with the Trump sign, like, down the street. Like,
yeah.
If that's,
yeah,
like, his military thing, make the military more efficient,
and obviously,
I'm good.
Obviously, like, make the military stronger always plays well. So that's the main reason, because it's the, I mean, no one would ever say, let's make the military softer.
Yeah, but so words have meaning. When we hear stronger, the implication is that we're weak.
Yeah,
that,
and that's
what
we're
weak.
And right.
We're not.
Of course.
And we're that's not. One of the things about Make America Great Again. If it needs to be made again, it's not currently great.
Yeah.
Agreed. And so, which I disagree with. It's you know, that's, we don't need to make it great again. It's fantastic. We need to make it a little bit better.
But
I don't
you
think
could
you
say Make America Greater.
Yeah.
Right. Right. We'll come up with those ZBT hats. Make America Greater.
Make America
currently
Greater.
Make the podcast greater again.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I just think that with military, I mean, we're already, we're like bigger than the next, you know, 4, 5, 6 militaries combined, whatever you want to call it. So I don't think, I agree with you, Chaps. There shouldn't be a focus on, like, let's make the military way bigger and stronger. Let's just make it as fucking efficient as possible because we're already gigantic.
And that's one thing that having somebody like General Mattis and General Petraeus in positions, Because even if Petraeus didn't get the appointment, he's still going to be in the president's ear. Like, you know that. I mean, he's going to, if anybody, he's going to be in Mattis's ear. Like, he's going to have him as a confidant. Like, Petraeus not going anywhere. He's too brilliant of a military mind to not be used in some facet of foreign policy. So you're
can you imagine
have,
that text chain, Petraeus?
I want to get
Mattis
get
and Trump.
Yeah. Let's add him to the ZBT, ZBT group chat.
Yeah, absolutely. Get him on the G-chat.
ZBT G-chat.
Yeah. I think they need us.
You know what else they need?
What do they need?
They need Blue Apron.
Oh, yeah.
Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient recipe delivery service in the country. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. Blue Apron achieves this by supporting a more sustainable food program, setting the highest standard for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs like your boy. Blue Apron has established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranches across the United States, and as a result, the seafood is sourced sustainably under standards developed by partnerships on the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch. That sounds pretty fucking legit.
Absolutely.
Anytime you have a name that has three independent proper nouns, it's legit.
Mm-hmm.
I support it.
Totally agree.
Blue Apron can be developed to 99% of the continental U.S. and 99.5% of food desserts. Yeah. So cooking together builds strong family bonds. That's true. My family, my kids love it when we fucking cook together.
It really is a fun activity.
It is. Like, especially like pancakes. They get to, if I let my daughter cook a Blue Apron box, she would shit herself. In a good way. So those who spend a lot of money in restaurant high end, because if you are a dad, and I know a lot of military people listen, and you start like me, you fucker start having kids real quick, get Blue Apron, man, because it'll help you out. You don't have to wait in the long lines at the commissary or where the fuck you get your food now. Spicy shrimp and Korean rice, words that I can't even say, pork chops, garlic. Like, it's fancy stuff, man.
Yeah.
And so you don't go out and spend $30 on a plate. You'll spend less than that for your entire family. So blueapron.com.
You know what's cool about Blue Apron, too, is you hit on it. Like, you're going to make foods that you never in a million years would have made for yourself.
Yeah.
Because you have no idea. But it makes it, I mean, it's so easy. All the ingredients, follow the instructions, bingo, bango, you get a great meal. Yep.
I am the worst cook in the world.
Yeah.
Mostly because I grew up, my mom just didn't cook.
Mm-hmm.
My dad works, so he didn't cook.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would just get fast food all the time. We're all playing sports all the time. So
yep.
We would just be in the car, get fast food or order pizza or whatever, never cook. I feel like if your parents don't really cook, it's hard to really get into it.
Yep.
And so I'm the worst cook in the fucking world. So anything that makes it easier.
They give you step-by-step instructions, and you can get it everything they guarantee can be prepared in less than 40 minutes. So all you have to do, go to blueapron.com/zero. Z-E-R-O, and get that shit going today.
And I'm going to make one Zero Blog 30 specific recommendation. Open up a nice bottle of red.
Ooh.
While you're doing it.
Yeah. I'm all about full body red.
I've been on a big red kick lately.
Oh, yeah?
Dude, a red wine. Ugh. That'll really get it going.
We might have to have a ZBT outing where we just go to a nice wine bar.
Maybe we'll start doing little wine reviews. ZBT, wow. That would be such a contrast. Of,
yeah.
Like, the ZBT.
I like it.
I don't want to be boxed in. Like, that's what people are always surprised. Because I am, and I admit it, I am a lot more liberal than most veterans, I would say.
Yeah, you are. I would agree with that.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I think so.
But I don't feel like it's – I feel like I try to approach it from a common sense area.
Definitely.
Like, so that's where I'm coming from. And I don't care about your little things where you want to just go drink fucking cheap-ass beer all the time. Occasionally, I want a full body red.
Yeah,
so
nothing wrong with
again.
That. Yeah,
whatever.
The only issue I have with red is that I'm just generally a sloppy person.
Yep.
So I spill it all the time. It's not a major spill. It's just, you know, I'll take too big of a step and it just like will slip over the side of the glass
sure.
on my way to the kitchen or something
mm-hmm.
and just like dribble onto my sleeve.
Yeah, that's
and I'm
that's
like
not,
motherfucker. It's my only complaint. Which again, it's not the product's fault.
No, but my only complaint is the wine teeth that you get if you go
lips.
Real
yeah.
real hard. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
true.
You don't know if you got punched in the mouth because you're spitting in the sink and it's all red.
Yep,
shit.
Yep,
yeah. All right. So anyway, that sponsor is going to our badass of the week,
legendary journalist Claire Hollingworth, who essentially began her whole career a little lucky, actually. She basically broke that World War II was starting.
Pretty big news.
It was August 28th, 1939. She had been at the Daily Telegraph for less than a week. And she's driving from, I believe she had about a 20-minute drive, and it was from Germany, some small city in Germany, to some small place in Poland.
Mm-hmm.
As she's driving across, super windy day, August 20th, I believe it's 28th, 39, the waterproof kind of tarp blows open over a massive, massive collection of German tanks, all kinds of equipment. She's like, what the fuck's going on there? Calls her editor. They break the news. They publish it the next day that Germany's getting ready to invade. September 1st, they do invade Poland, kick off World War One. Over the course of, you know, the next 60 years, she basically would be everywhere, breaking all kinds of news. She obviously, you know, broke all kinds of stuff throughout the entire World War II. And then in 1965, she was looking really hard to get kind of info, interviews between the India-Pakistan confrontation, secured a permission from Indira Gandhi, who was actually the only female prime minister in their history. So she's breaking news already. And then she would go on in 1963. She ID'd what was known as the third man, British spy with a Russian spy ring. So anyway, she had tons and tons of breaks. She had one legendary quote where she was married, I believe, twice. She was got divorced.
Not bad for 100 years.
No, not bad. She died. She was 105 when she died this week. And she had a great quote where, you know, her broke up or got divorced from her first husband. Somebody was interviewing her about her. And she said, when I'm on a story, I'm on a story. To hell with my husband, my family, anyone else.
Wow.
Badass.
That is badass.
Badass motherfucker. She, and through her 90s, would occasionally sleep on her floor, her hardwood floor, in her home because she feared of becoming too soft.
Wow.
And she lived in Hong Kong, right?
Yeah. She died in Hong Kong. She actually was in Tiananmen Square. During the protests in, what were those, 89?
Yes.
As like, you know, think if she's 105, she was old as shit at that point. She was like climbing up on lampposts, getting pictures and stuff. So anyway, badass of the week, awesome journalist. My favorite, since we're kind of doing Zero Blog Theater, my favorite thing anytime we talk about badass journalists is just to look at the movie Spotlight.
Oh, yeah.
And what those motherfuckers had to go through to get that story. And then imagine someone like Claire doing this in war.
Yeah. I mean, a great example of that is the documentary Restrepo, done by that journalist whose name is escaping me right now. Forgive me for that. But if you haven't seen Restrepo, I mean, to see what a journalist goes through on the front lines of war is wild.
And to think, too, any journalist, any wartime journalist that becomes well-known, and think about all that they're going through, and then she is the greatest, the GOAT of all of them.
Yeah.
I mean, whenever I see, like, a cool video of like people fighting in a high school cafeteria, and I blog it first, I'm like, hell yeah.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what it would be like. I just broke World War II.
100%. 100%. So, I mean, it feels good to break something. Everybody loves even like breaking gossip to their buddies or something.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, imagine.
It's like that scene from The Office when you're like, you know about Stan.
Yep. Yeah. Then he starts all the fake rumors to try to hide the real one. So,
and, you know, to credit her even more, like back then, World War II. Newspapers were so prevalent. I mean, that was basically everyone's source of news.
And it was so hard. I mean, a lot of these, think about, you know, of Nazi Germany. I mean, journalists didn't exist. They weren't allowing anything to get out that wasn't propaganda, et cetera, et cetera. So she's one of few people. This is a time, too, I mean, to get your information from what you've compiled on the ground, front lines, to, you know, an editor who then publishes and gets it out. Well, you can't just tweet that shit out.
No.
That's a battle, and she's taking fire.
Yeah, like the next day, like you said, it broke the next day in the story. Like now, if Al Roker farts in the fucking Oval Office, you know about it in 10 seconds. I mean,
right, she legit saw it in the morning, and it wasn't of the 28th. It wasn't until the 29th, the following day, they were able to publish that fucking Germany's ready to invade and start World War II. So a war that would go on to kill, I believe, 60 million people. So, I mean, it's ridiculous.
And then for her to continue and have an impressive career for such a long duration. I'm always impressed by anyone who can maintain their career for an extended period of time past, like, the normal average shelf life of that profession.
And in doing, like I said, my research, when I started reading, you know, that story, because that's very lucky. But it's amazing how that luck, and then all of a sudden she would go on throughout her entire career. That's why I tried to list a few examples of just having that keen eye for covert information, stories nobody else had. She was always there, always breaking it. So, badass of the week. Claire Hollingworth. Legend.
First female badass of the week, too, so shout out to her for that. Because it was so easy for guys to serve, the women who ended up serving in World War II, World War I time frame were so fucking badass.
Yeah, because they had to go above and beyond.
It was basically like really real life Milan, like where they would have to like dress up like dudes to like to get in. Or,
I was going
to
say, they had to like pretend like they were dudes.
Yeah, I mean, just some of those stories of people from that generation, lots of badass. And not to mention the fact of what they were doing in the factories in World War II, getting America ready. Like, the women back home in the 1940s. The men get called the greatest generation a lot, but they aren't the greatest generation without those hard-nosed fucking women behind them, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I was going to say, even think about Claire. I mean, this was 1939. Think about where women were.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I think we're still not quite all the way there.
Yeah.
This was 20, 30 years before we really got to, you know.
How much do you think it ate at all those other
ones? Oh, yeah.
Oh, my
How much did those
God.
Male
they
journalists fucking hate
I bet
her.
She'd be like, yeah, suck these tits, bitch. I fucking owned your ass. No, she Biggest didn't. Scoop in legit the history of the world. The only scoop bigger than World War II starting is Jesus is back out of the tomb.
Yeah, that's it.
That's it.
And she
that's
nailed
the
it.
The other scoop you want.
No, dude, she would get fucking arrested all the time because other journalists would be like, she's got to be a spy. I don't know how she's getting that shit. Everybody
when
called her a
so
spy.
When you're so good at being a journalist, people assume you're a spy. That's why you're badass of the week.
She got arrested all the time. Everybody thought she was a spy. That's how good you are.
I love it.
Yeah, man. All right, so we're going to transition to Zero Block Theater.
I'm pumped.
Yeah, me too. Zero Block Theater is brought to you by the good folks at Odd Sharks. You're big-time football games. This podcast will be released on Sunday morning. So you have the divisional round, which is by far the best weekend of football, in my opinion, because you have four really good teams that are left. You have two games each day, and it's a full day of drinking, full day of hanging out, full day of football. Make some money on it, too, and go to Odd Shark. Odd Shark has everything that sports bettors need, from detailed matchup reports to expert editorial with the best odds with sports books from around the globe, and it's all free. Oddsharks.com. Oddsharks.com. Speak well, chaps. Thanks. Your best bet for this football season. All right. So I talked about it a little bit on Twitter. This watch through, I said that I hadn't watched Saving Private Ryan since I joined the Marine Corps. I was mistaken. I had actually never watched it.
Ever?
No.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I think I'd seen so many clips throughout, like, in just different
Yeah, it's on
scenes,
TNT, like, every weekend.
But I never sat down and watched it.
I kind of got that vibe from our G-chat, because you were kind of like live G-chatting.
Yeah,
I was. Your reaction.
And I'll be honest with you, boys, I couldn't get through the whole thing.
Is that right?
Could not.
When did you stop it?
Let me look at my notes. I stopped it.
Did you get through the sniper scene?
I stopped it when the mom collapsed.
All right, that's pretty early on in the movie.
A little bit after the mom collapsed.
Wow, okay, that's very early on in the movie. I mean, and that's...
No, I went a little bit further, to Jackson's gripe. Right?
Okay.
That's where I stopped.
Okay, all right. Because
I could tell some shit was about to go down. I was like,
oh, no.
I can't do this again.
Nah, but...
not today.
I mean, that speaks to a lot of the World War II veterans. There was massive reports when the movie first came out in theaters. So many veterans had to just walk out of the theater because Steven Spielberg had done such a fantastic job accurately depicting what it was like on those beaches of Normandy. And I always marvel at that. And when I think about Band of Brothers, guys parachuting in, like, you're on a boat coming up to this beach, and you know as soon as that ramp goes down, there are bullets that are going to be coming at you. And not just a few, like, lots of machine guns were trying to kill these men, and they still forged ahead. It was like, well, this is our mission. This is what we're going to do. So the fact that he was able to recreate that in such great detail, I mean, obviously I wasn't there, but from everything I've read from veterans that were there on the beaches that day, they said it was scarily accurate.
Yeah, the things that I want to kind of start chronologically through the movie, but you're absolutely right. Like, the way that the bodies looked after they were getting mangled with bullets, it just looked incredibly real, like what it looks like in real life, and how they did it was just incredible. So one of the first things that I wanted to bring up was, and this, they have so many scenes that I saw, the reaction from people was the same reaction that I have had or I've seen people have.
Mm-hmm.
Like, one, the first time that I went to Arlington National Cemetery after I was a war veteran, the guttural reaction of seeing all the white stone was powerful.
Yeah.
And that's how basically they kicked off it off with an old man walking to those stones and to see the gravestone. It just shows for the fact that you know that that old man wasn't an old man. He had been living in that body for at least 50 years after, and that was the response. And I feel like that shows why being a veteran is so important to so many people, because when you experience something like that, not to the same scale as Normandy, obviously, but when you experience something like that, it's not going to go away. And it is a wake-up, I think, for veterans our age that some of the things, and that's why suicide is so prevalent,
mm-hmm.
because those feelings that that guy had, it was clear that they were there 50, 60 years after he had returned home already.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just as you're speaking and describing that scene right now, I keep getting chills that go through my body because I have those same feelings, that same guttural reaction. And it really is truly a powerful sight, because when you take a step back and you think about what that represents, all that sacrifice, it really is just a very powerful, overwhelming feeling.
Yeah, I mean, it's stunning, and it's, you know, for me, I'm a big World War I, World War II buff.
Yep.
And the type of warfare that was going on then, I mean, I wrote a bunch of numbers down just to compare. I mean, those people, and the main reason I want to bring up the numbers is because those people knew that they're going to die. I mean, there's a very good chance.
That's what I'm talking about. When you're getting off that boat, you're like, you know, like, ah.
And at the beginning, when they show those guys puking,
yes.
vomiting,
I had that written
peeing,
down too.
And the reason, again, I'm going to bring up the numbers now, you know, 60 million people died in World War II, 3% of the global population. The U.S. lost 400,000-something people. Russia was between 8 and 11 million people that died. And now, I mean, even if you look at our last two biggest conflicts between Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, it's very low thousands.
Yeah.
And those have been going on for 10 years. And the only reason I bring that up, not to diminish anything, just to show that those people, nowadays, you never think, even going in, like, I'm definitely going to die here.
Mm-hmm.
It's much different.
You know that it's an option that you might, but you don't have
impending
exactly.
fear.
Those guys on those boats knew either they were or the person next to them was going to die.
Yeah.
They were prepared. They had things written down. They had everything set. Like, there's a very good chance I'm probably going to die here, or my best buddy, or five of my best buddies, or my three brothers are going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And that is just unbelievable.
Yeah, absolutely.
When I was watching it, I also thought to myself, thank fucking God I wasn't alive in the 1940s.
Right?
Like, because some of the things that they did, even, like, tactically speaking, like, sure, we've learned from a lot, but somebody was like, would you rush the machine gun or would you go around? To me, no one Monday morning quarterbacks anything like they do war.
Oh, yeah.
Because when bullets are flying, if you think that you're elevating yourself and looking on a map, sure, if you're a strategic guy and you're back on the FOB and you're doing things like that, you can think about it. When you're on the battlefield, you're not thinking that way. You're thinking about it to a certain degree, but like I said before, like on the rundown, where I said I didn't go in front of the window. Sure, tactically, I knew I wasn't supposed to go in the window. I also know that if I don't get my ass to the window fast and start laying down rounds, that we're going to get taken.
Mm.
So what you think that you should do in every single tactical situation and what you're actually able to do in every tactical situation are totally different.
Yeah, absolutely. I told the story in an earlier episode about how I had my soldier freeze up that first time that first bullet flew, because you can't know how you're going to react till you're in that situation. So those guys, to continue to just press forward, despite the fact that they're just being rained down on, because, I mean, the Germans had every freaking advantage you would want in a battle in Normandy. And these gentlemen, these soldiers just continued to press up the beach and storm that beach.
So there's a good example of that, like the fear. And I've said it plenty of times. It's one of my favorite quotes ever, that courage isn't the absence of fear. It's the presence of mind to move forward despite fear.
Yep.
And I learned that from a dude that I was with in a reconnaissance unit. He, every time he was in a firefight, he pissed himself. So, but he kept going back.
Yep.
And he did it so often. He had been in so many firefights that he would start the mission with a diaper on because he knew he was going to do it. He was like, it's a physiological reaction. I can't help it.
But this is what I do.
He's like, but I don't give a fuck. He's like, I'm not a coward. This is just how my body reacts, and I'm going to move forward. So whenever you say you freeze up, how your body responds to it, it's how your mind goes afterwards.
Absolutely.
Like,
yeah.
Do you run from that fear or do you push forward in the face of fear? And I think that dealing with fear is something that is really hard to wrap your mind around because you don't know how you do it. Like, there are certain situations that I was in where I was absolutely fucking terrified out of my mind. But you keep going.
Yeah. And I think Tom Hanks, Captain Miller, in this case, in this movie, displayed that very well. because you saw the two sides of being a platoon leader. And Chaps, I think you were talking to me about this earlier when we were talking about that first scene where they're walking up the mountainside or mm-hmm. the hillside, and they're kind of talking, and you see the different sides of an officer and the enlisted guys.
So what Connor's talking about is there's a scene where there's a PFC who's walking with the captain, and the PFC is just going off about everything that's fucked up in the war, like what the mission that they have, and the captain's just kind of listening to it, and so is the platoon sergeant, which is pretty common where your level of leadership, whenever you're in a situation that is obviously shitty, you'll give your troops a little bit more of a leash to mm-hmm. kind of hang themselves with before mm-hmm. you really draw them back, because if you correct every single little bitching, you won't move 3 feet without a correction. They're going to bitch. It's what they do.
Yep.
And you want them to be angry motherfuckers. Like, if you want people to wage war, they need to be angry. So let them be angry a little bit. But the PFC asks the captain, what do you think about it? Like, what are some of your complaints about what's going on? And what does he say, Connor?
Well, he basically, in a nutshell, I'm going to paraphrase because I don't remember the exact lines, but he's basically saying how he thinks it's a great mission and we're going to execute it to the best of our ability. And ultimately, what he was saying was that he's never going to bitch down to his soldiers, because when you're a platoon leader, it can sometimes be a very lonely thing, because there's kind of like two sides. You have to be one person in front of your soldiers, while simultaneously you might be a completely different person. And I thought Hanks did a good job of showing this when he's in front of his soldiers. He was a very good leader. He was smart. He thought well under pressure. But then you see the scenes where he's by himself and he has no one to confide in but himself. And he's crying. He's shaking. He's very afraid himself, but he can't show that in front of his men. And I think that's a great display of what it is like to be a platoon leader.
I think it's very telling, too. There's a couple different scenes where he's kind of going over with the map.
Mm-hmm.
And he's drawing out where they're going, and that's the first time they can see his hands shaking
mm-hmm.
so badly. And you can see they do such a good job cinematically of showing the troops kind of look, giving each other eye contact.
Because they notice
it. And he's battling right through it, like, no, I'm the fucking leader. Everything's fine. And it really kind of brings the two together.
And it shows, too, like, that you respect that. Like, you don't want somebody that's going to be in that position to be bullshitting you. Like, I had a captain. His name was Captain Rose. Captain Rose told us, like, before we went out on this one mission, this is the most dangerous road in the fucking world right now. It is by far the most dangerous road in the world. I'm scared shitless to go down this road, but we're going to go down this road. We're going to do it fucking like Marines.
Yep.
And you're just like, all right. You're like, well, if you put it that way, let's do it.
And I mean, you have to be vulnerable sometimes like that. And I thought it was interesting, too, like when the running joke is, you know, ask the captain what he does back home. Nobody knows really about him, because as a platoon leader, you can't be like buddies and friends. The way, Chaps, I'm sure, you know, you had closeness with your other NCOs. You guys can confide in one another. You're more like friends. You have that outlet to speak to someone honestly, where nobody knew anything about him because he just never allowed himself to become their friend. He was always their leader.
And there is elements of that with the relationship between the platoon sergeant and the squad leaders and the platoon commander, too, like in real life. You don't really see it as much in the movie as really is portrayed, because the officer relies on him and you rely on him, too, because you got to have that decent relationship.
Yeah, and I thought they showed a great aspect of the platoon leader, platoon sergeant relationship.
They
did. Yeah, between Tom Sizemore and Tom Hanks. They had, you know, Sizemore had the utmost respect for him, and then he would pass his orders down and tell these soldiers, like, hey, this is what we're doing. This is what the captain wants us to do. So it was a great depiction.
Opposite. All right. Here is my favorite scene from it, because, you know, like I talked about in We Were Soldiers, there's certain elements of leadership that I absolutely fucking love about just being a military guy in general.
Yep.
And this one was it. They had just stormed the beaches. They're finally break through. The water is stained red. I mean, the pink mist part was like stunningly accurate how it looks. And they get to the ridge, and he finally gets to a radio. And Tom Hanks' character says, the first wave was ineffective. We do not hold the beach. And he says it incredibly calm. Even though there was piles of bodies everywhere, he gets on the radio. He doesn't freak out. He's not like, oh, my fucking God.
Yeah.
He just says, the first wave was ineffective. We do not hold the beach. I was just like, God damn, man. Like, because that's what happens. That's what my view is on how people get reported things back home. You hear about, and it was me before I went. You hear about how bad at the time Fallujah was. Like, Fallujah is the Wild West. Well, sure, that gives you a little bit of a picture. But until you can actually see what's going on, the first wave was ineffective.
Yeah.
We do not hold Fallujah.
Yeah. No, it's true.
No, even like thinking now, I'll see a headline just like Mosul's still up for grabs. You know, and that's just it. And
so,
you know,
just a little blurb, and there's so many things within that blurb. I mean, it's basically like numbers where you see 1, 2, and 3, but in between 1, 2, and 3, there's an infinite amount of numbers.
And it's a great scene because he's just super direct, and it's like, this is what my people need to know. They don't need to know about all the details. They don't need the visuals of what's going on.
Yeah.
They need the fucking information. I'm going to give it to them. That's it.
And then, you know, we'll react accordingly. So who's your guys' favorite character in the movie? Aside from Hanks. I think Hanks is by far and away the best, obviously. But who is your favorite?
Who's his main guy there?
Is Platoon Sergeant?
Yeah.
Sergeant Horvath?
Yeah. That guy's awesome.
Yeah, I liked him too. I liked it whenever the scene where he threatens to shoot the dude who's trying to walk away.
Yeah, that's actually...
That's a great scene.
I would say I like Eddie Burns the best in this movie. Just because I think, you know, he portrays like the gritty guy from New York. He's tough, but...
I'll shoot you because you're a dumb motherfucker.
Yeah. No, I'm going to shoot you because you're a dumb motherfucker.
Yeah.
Yeah, not because you're not following this order.
You're going to shoot me because I don't follow Captain... No, I'm going to shoot you because you're a dumb motherfucker who doesn't know how to shut his damn mouth.
Yes. Yeah, oh my God. Like, that right there, that is the epitome of a platoon sergeant, or in your case, chaps, a gunny sergeant. It's just awesome.
So there was a couple scenes, too, that remind me of boot camp. Did you guys use this phrase? I'm up, they see me, I'm down.
Yes, sir.
And I just kept thinking that when he's like, storm that, he's like, you're going to piss off his mom if she ever finds out that you sent him on that mission. He's like, yeah. Like, that's what you train for at boot camp. Like, we do constantly the up, I'm see me, I'm down drills. And the whole time you're like, this is stupid. But then you watch shit like that, like you see clips, you're like, that's what we do. I'm up, they see me, I'm down.
And what
makes yourself harder.
Exactly.
Like, and if they would have done it on fucking Game of Thrones, the young Snowboy would have still been alive.
There you go. And what Chaps is referring to, that when you say, if you're trying to advance and you're trying to run, you say in your head, I'm up, they see me, I'm down. And that's the amount of time you should be running and standing up. By the time you're finished saying, I'm up, they see me, I'm down, you should be back down on the ground. It's a way to bound so that you're not up so long that you can present yourself as a target.
Yeah, you don't want somebody to get a beat on you, basically.
Yeah. Gotcha. So you're timing their process. Like,
yes.
What it takes.
So you're like, I'm up, I'm running, they see me, I'm down.
Yes. Gotcha. Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you're only running, you're not making a whole lot of ground. And that's the thing in combat. When you're trying to gain ground, every inch is important, and you never give up the inch.
Exactly. My favorite part, though, or not maybe my favorite part, one part I really liked was when he was going to get Corporal Upham, the translator guy who's, you know, obviously stuck behind a typewriter, not really used to combat.
Yes, I love this part too.
And he's in the tent and he's like trying to like bring all his gear and he's like grabbing a typewriter and everything, and then Hanks just cool, Captain Miller just cool as a cucumber, is like just like taking stuff and like throwing it on the ground like, you're not gonna need that shit. I mean, he didn't say that, but he's just
like what is, he grabs the I think he grabs a Nazi helmet.
Yeah.
And he's like, what is this, a souvenir?
Yeah.
Like, grab the other one.
Yeah, yeah. You're going to need that.
You're not going to need your typewriter. Put that down. Go get your gear. And he's just, like, so calm. And the kid is so nervous, one, because he's around a captain. It was probably his first time really around, like, officers. And then he just doesn't know what to do. And it's like, there's a little thing. I don't know if I've explained it before. Have I explained diarrhea fingers, what diarrhea fingers are?
No.
So you can, as a senior guy, senior enlisted guy or officer, you can walk in to a room with junior enlisted folks. And a lot of times, if they haven't been around that, or if you have an intimidating presence, they'll get what I call diarrhea fingers. So whenever you have diarrhea and you're somewhere and you need to take a shit really fast.
Oh, yeah, you can't get your pants off.
Yeah, you're just fumbling around with your fingers and you can't button. You know your fingers should work. You've done it 1,000 times, but your fingers don't work as fast. So you basically have to rip your buttons off because your brain won't control your fingers like they normally do. And that's how these guys get, and that's how he got with the typewriter. He's probably picked up that typewriter 100 times, but he had diarrhea fingers, so he fucking dropped it.
Yeah. What'd you guys think of the mission overall? The idea that the 8 guys were going to go. And mind you, only 2 of them survived. So 8 guys went in, 2 survived just to save 1 person.
So I was trying to do a little research. I mean, that's not based off a true story.
It's loosely based off a story.
It's based off a doctrine.
I was going to say, that was my guess.
It was based off a wartime doctrine.
Okay, right.
Yeah, but no, but I believe there was an example in World War II.
Well, I'm sure there would have been, because of the numbers. There's so many going on.
No, but I'm a geek. I always go on IMDb when I'm watching movies, and I read take IMDb for what it's worth, but the trivia was that it was loosely based on the family whose name I'm blanking on right now.
Gotcha.
But, I mean, there is precedent.
I'm just talking about the doctrine of it.
Oh, yeah,
right.
Yeah.
See, absolutely. That would have been my guess, that it's based off a doctrine, and that's, you know, that
oh,
this
yeah.
is a real
the
life thing yeah. that they had
the
to make a doctrine
kind
for.
Of antiquated at this point, but...
Yeah.
If it was still around, I would not like it.
Who is it? The guys in the...
But you can make the same argument. I mean, that's basically what we did for Bo Bergdahl, too. Like, going to look for him, where you're sacrificing people to go look.
Who was the family...
In a very different way, but
the
same
family
kind
of brothers,
idea.
The family of brothers who served in the Navy, and they were all... The Sullivans, they all served on the same ship. Ship got blown up, so the mother lost all her sons. So after that, they were like, all right, brothers will never serve in the same unit ever again.
Interesting. But, okay.
I had a family... That the dad was the first sergeant, and there was a Lance Corporal son.
Oof. That's interesting.
I was surprised they let it keep.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Because that's a pretty clear fraternization.
There's a lot of implications.
Interest and...
Yeah, I was going to say, just on the mission, I mean, I feel like it's easy to say now that it doesn't seem worth it. But at the time, again, when so many people are dying and so many communities are just being ripped apart, I mean, there's no way that any community, especially for any of the countries and militaries in Europe, but us too, with so many people dying, I mean, everybody had to know people that had lost people or neighbors that had lost sons and all of that. So it makes sense that there would have been the doctrine, and therefore you just go. And so again, I think it's easier now to say why that mission's not worth it.
Yep.
But again, at the time, I think you got to try to keep. You got to try to help. Some families, they can't lose four sons. I mean, that's ridiculous. So I can understand it. But, again, right now, if I had to, I would agree with Japs. And I could be against it.
All right, so we'll go around one more time. Save Ryan's alibis about Saving Private Ryan. Mine is the dude who's also named Ryan, who was told that his brothers were killed and they were in grave school.
Yeah.
It really just kind of goes to show, at that point, you couldn't just hop on a phone, go to the internet cafe, and fucking Facebook your family. It was taking months for letters to get there. So you legitimately have no idea, and you're a wreck about what's happening at your family. They don't know what the fuck's going on with you. Like, sometimes the letters would take 6 months, a year before they would get to you, and then sometimes they would just get flooded all at one time.
Mm.
I mean, that would have been terrible. There are so many things about war in the 40s that was just god-awful, man.
Yeah. Riggsy?
This is just what our favorite, our most...
Just anything. Any random thought that you'd like to make about Saving Private Ryan in general?
I thought the sniper scene where, the German sniper shoots one of the, I can't remember the guy's name, one of the guy's names.
Caparzo?
He's lying out
Vin
there.
Diesel?
Yeah, Vin Diesel.
Caparzo.
He's lying out there.
Yep.
And the fucking sniper leaves him alive.
Yeah.
As just, bait.
Yep.
To try to get one of the other guys to come out so he can shoot more of
Incredibly
them.
Real.
And it just speaks to how cruel fucking war is.
Yeah.
That these guys, you know, in 10, 15 years later, if those people had been born, they could probably be buddies that would run into each other at a bar while torn in a different country. But instead, these motherfuckers were caught up in that era, and one of them's shooting a guy and then trying to use him as bait to kill another guy.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that spoke to how real it is and just speaks to how phenomenal of a job they did of making this movie so goddamn realistic.
And speaking of what made it really good, and I think this is something that probably people don't even think of it when they're watching it, but if I say this, hopefully it'll resonate with some people. I think one of the things that makes that movie so good is the score of the movie. So when they're just walking and they're not saying any words and the music behind what's going on, it was, to me, very powerful. Fun fact.
You son of a bitch.
What?
I tweeted this week that I used cheap pens and it hurt my... And I see a fucking Mont Blanc on your goddamn shirt. You motherfucker.
Unrelated, but I'm sorry about that.
you just
Connor,
looked at me.
You son of a bitch.
You just looked at me and your face turning. You got so goddamn pissed. That was fantastic.
Chaps,
it was a gift. I didn't buy it.
You.
It was a gift. It was a gift from my
parents.
All right,
so just that. I'm going to even use this phrase. I'm going to cut you off. You're done.
No, hold on. No, come on.
All right, go ahead.
Fun fact. So all the guys, the actors, before the movie started, they went to like a little boot camp to get used to being in the military. Spielberg specifically left Damon out of that, though. So they would have resentment towards Matt Damon for not having to do all the shitty training that they had to do and then make it more realistic that they didn't like him when they had to go save him in the movie.
Wow.
Damn.
That is
Spielberg,
a hell of a
man.
Fun fact.
Spielberg. I mean, he's obviously the GOAT for a reason.
That guy will leave no stone unturned. To
absolutely,
make a good movie.
Absolutely. So I mean, just a phenomenal movie. And I mean, if it doesn't bring you to tears at the end when he salutes the grave, I mean, I don't know, your heart's not beating.
All right, so that's Zero Block 30 Theater, man. Like, that was good. And because the album was so heavy, we make a command decision. We didn't even put it out on Twitter. Next week, we're going to do Major Pain.
All right, that's
yes.
a good one.
Keep
that's
it a little
one.
Bit lighter.
Yes.
Absolutely.
We're going to go Major Pain.
Great choice.
So thanks for everybody for listening. We'll have some interviews coming up next week that will be pretty fun, too, with the NFL playoffs rolling around. So it's going to be a good time.